Hello, and welcome to the Full Circle Healing Podcast, where we merge modern cutting-edge science with traditional healing wisdom and everything in between to help you come full circle back to your original, natural state of health and well-being. I'm your host, Michael, and over the last 15 years, I've helped hundreds of thousands of people find the information, practices, tools, resources, and experts they needed to find their way back to optimal health. Our guest in this episode is my friend and go-to source of health information for kids, Dr. Elisa Song. Dr. Song is a Stanford, NYU, UCSF-trained integrative pediatrician, pediatric functional medicine expert, and mom to two thriving children, who's on a mission to revolutionize the future of children's health. Dr. Song is also the best-selling author of The Healthy Kids, Happy Kids, an integrative pediatrician's guide to whole child resilience book, which sits on my shelf as we're currently raising a little one ourselves. In her integrative pediatric practice, she's helped thousands of kids get to the root causes of their health concerns and empowered patients to help their children thrive by integrating conventional pediatrics with functional medicine, homeopathy, acupuncture, herbal medicine, and other natural-minded approaches. In this episode, you're going to learn how the gut-brain connection shapes kids' health, immunity, emotions, and more, how to cultivate microbiome magic to prevent childhood allergies, skin issues, mood disorders, and chronic health conditions, how to make mealtime fun and healthy with the POP, Plants on Purpose method, and the three Fs every parent should focus on, and practical ways to teach kids mindfulness, breathing, nervous system regulation, and vagus nerve stimulation practices that will help their health and wellness as children and as they grow into adults. And if you'd like to learn some of those breathing practices right now that you can start right away with your kids, head over and grab my Breathing for Nervous System Regulation ebook at rebelhealth.co/breathing. Now let's go learn how to make healthy, fun, and practical for your kids with Dr. Song. And we're live, another episode of the Full Circle Healing Podcast, and we are here with Dr. Elisa Song. Dr. Song, thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me. I always love chatting with you.
Me too. I have such fun conversations with you. And it's the only time I really doing this talk a lot about children's health. And now that I have a little guy, my other child was pretty much grown up by the time I started working in this field. So now that I have a little guy around, these conversations seem more, I'm more drawn to them, but it's still fascinating to see and hear what's going on with kids' health that's mimicking and kind of following trajectories of adults' health, for better or worse. And today we're going to talk about a different angle. I know we've done presentations and conversations around like toxins in kids and stress in kids and hormones in kids for the masterclass we just recorded. But this is more about like practicality and how to, your book has incredible recommendations and tips and suggestions. And I guess first I want to ask, like, are kids really that much different than we are as far as the things that are good for their health versus things that I think a lot of people who listen to this podcast might already be thinking they need to do for themselves, but they might not equate that for their kids? Are they that different?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, in the sense that, you know, kids' brains and microbiomes and immune systems are developing so rapidly. So that opens up a couple of things. I mean, on the one hand, because they are in the process of really developing into their adult-like state, I mean, from the inside out, any hit or hits to their immune system, their microbiome, their nervous system can have downstream very long-term consequences on their future health, you know, even when they're adolescents or adults. So, you know, there is this sort of, oh, we have to be a little bit more careful because the impact could be more severe. At the same time, there's such plasticity. We know there's that even in adults, brains have so much plasticity, but oh my gosh, I mean, kids' brains have so much plasticity in their infants, toddler years. I mean, you know, with Elio, I mean, just the next morning, you're like, oh, he's a different kid, right? He's like doing different things. And that same thing, that same explosion happens in your, you know, tween and teen years. I mean, your brain doesn't stop developing. And same thing with our microbiomes. I mean, a lot of people listening have heard of the first 1,000 days of microbiome development, how important that is, the first 2.5 years. But, you know, guess what? The microbiome also has a dramatic increase and shift in your pubertal years. So when you're, again, a tween and teen, and same thing with our immune system. And so we have these opportunities where we can continue to make these shifts for the better if we know how. And all of the foundations that folks listening to this podcast are already thinking about for themselves and how they're eating and living and, you know, sleeping and doing all of that, it absolutely applies to children. And when we understand the foundations of why those apply and how to apply those to kids, we have this, I mean, I think just these golden opportunities to help kids become even more resilient and healthier through their lives.
Thanks. And so you mentioned plasticity a lot, and I think neuroplasticity is, you know, kind of how the brain tends to rewire itself. And that's talked about a lot now for adults. Like, you want to learn a new habit, so you do this in a certain way and you reward yourself and it forms these new connections in the brain. So you're saying that happens faster or easier for kids or both?
Both. I mean, their brains are remodeling every day. The thing, though, that we have to understand about brain development in kids, brains develop from kind of the back forward. And so the back is really our senses, our emotions. And as we move further and further forward, we have our prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for rational decision making. And that really, you know, doesn't start to fully develop until you're a teenager. And it's still not completely developed until you're really in your 20s. I mean, for boys, it's not until you're in your late 20s. And then add on top of that, if you have ADHD or other neurodevelopmental concern, probably later, right? I mean, we can see that even in some 30-year-olds, you're like, oh, your brain's still developing, right? And so, you know, these kids, we can start to really see they can, I think, even at very young ages, fully understand the impact of their choices. I mean, as we kind of speak about it in, you know, age-appropriate terms, but we want to give our kids way more credit for understanding and being able to pick up these nuances in you know, the way we're living and you know, how we're going about our day-to-day lives. It's just that the rational decision-making prefrontal cortex isn't always kicked in. And so there's the difference between the knowing and the doing. And we as adults have enough trouble with that. I mean, we know that, right? How many times do we're like, oh, we know we should get more sleep, but it's 10 o'clock at night. You're like, oh, I still want to watch this movie or read this book or doom scroll, scroll through Instagram, right? And so, and you choose to stay up, even though you know you're going to suffer for it later. So with kids, we just want to continue to inform them about, you know, the different choices they can make and help them notice, connect the dots between the decisions that they're making and how they're feeling, you know, how their brain's feeling, how their body, their gut, how their immune system is reacting so that they can continue to make those informed decisions, right? And sometimes you still know, you're like, I know I'm going to feel like crap the next day, but I'm still going to do this thing, right? I mean, kids, of course, are going to do that same thing. And teens, of course, are going to do that thing. So we have to give them a little bit of grace because, I mean, nobody is perfect. But then, you know, you just say, oh, okay, well, how do you feel today after that? You know, the 10 pounds of cake that you ate after the French fries and the pizza, right? Well, let's just notice that. And let's think about the next time you have this opportunity of all of this food in front of you that may not necessarily be, you know, helping your brain feel as good as you want or your body feel as strong as you want. What decisions are you going to make? So, I mean, it's really very similar to how we as adults function.
Yeah. And I think the knowing versus doing gap, I think a few people might feel called out when they hear that, but, It is a choice, and helping them, you know, make it as a choice. So what are we talking about? I'm talking about, you know, dietary choices. Like you just mentioned in your book, you talk a lot about how kids can build healthy microbiomes, and it's, you know, a diverse diet, lots of colorful fruits and vegetables, different types of fibers and prebiotic kind of foods. Now, I have lived overseas for a few years and things are a little different here, but I know that is not probably a super common or typical way for kids in the States to eat. And I'm sure that's a reason why we're seeing so much rise in a lot of different chronic diseases as kids. But getting a kid on board with trying a bunch of new foods or eating in a different way than their friends eat or eating more vegetables or, you know, those kind of things, especially if it's, you know, somebody who's doing kind of an intervention, like their kid has health issues and they're trying to get them healthier. And it's kind of like almost an abrupt switch, like we were living like this and now we're going to eat like this and we're going to try these new foods. How do you find that goes over? Like, how do you navigate that with parents and with kids, especially maybe smaller kids, like, you know, under 10 or like that age? How do you navigate that?
So, I mean, I navigate everything with kids by just explaining it to them, because when they understand the why, even in very simple terms, it's so much easier for them to understand, you know, the how of it and be more committed to it. And I talk to kids from the very beginning about their microbiome, because as you know, we know, and especially for children, how their microbiome shapes and develops, especially in those early days, you know, again, those first 1,000 days from the moment they're born to about maybe 2.5 to 3 years of age, where the microbiome takes on a little bit more of an adult-like pattern. There is such a profound connection between how the microbiome shapes their developing immune system with, you know, if there's disruption, there can be increased risks for pretty much every single allergic disorder, which we are seeing on the rise, anaphylactic food allergies, eczema, asthma, hay fever, hives, and how the microbiome impacts their developing brains. We know disruption to their gut microbiome, especially early on, can significantly increase the risks for mental health concerns, depression, anxiety, sleep disorders when they are older kids and teenagers. So I don't talk to kids about that. I definitely share with parents, right, that we want to be informed about, you know, how kids' microbiomes become disrupted. But with kids, I talk to them about, you know, this amazing, amazing ecosystem inside their tummies. And, you know, as kids get older, even in preschool, kids are learning about taking care of the world, right? There's Earth Day, and we learn to, you know, reduce, reuse, recycle, you know, all the things to take care of our external, our world's ecosystem, because if we don't, the world will no longer be able to take care of us. Right. We are living in a way that we are disrupting the ability of the world to sustain us, which is really frightening. So I talked to them about this ecosystem inside their tummies, you know, these trillions of friends that live in their tummies that really are this ecosystem of microscopic organisms that take care of them, take care of not just their tummies, but, you know, their brains and how they think and feel and their immune system and, you know, how often they get sick or how quickly they bounce back from being sick, and even their muscles and, you know, learning how to play the piano or whatever it is. That's the role of your friends, your tiny little friends in your tummy. That is their job. And our job is to take care of that ecosystem. So then when kids really learn that and understand that, it's amazing what good, you know, stewards of their internal ecosystem they can be. I mean, I remember when my kids were learning about, you know, taking care of the earth and reducing and reusing and recycling, and they came home and they were so on top of me and Peter about that goes in the recycling and no, that goes in the green, you know, the green bin, right? Because they really felt like I'm responsible for this world. So, you know, kids can learn how to take ownership. And that goes to, you know, even so, let's say they're older. We can still talk about this model of this ecosystem, but then we make it really relevant for them. I mean, a middle schooler or an elementary school, for them, it may be, I want to have the most accurate, you know, free shots, free throws in basketball, right? Or I want to be, you know, really calm and know my lines for the school play. So we can tie pretty much every concern they have back with taking care of their microbiome. And for teenagers, I mean, their skin, right? The gut-skin connection with their acne, or, I mean, that gets a lot of kids, right? Like, it's their skin. Oh my gosh, I'm going to do something, right?
It would have got me if somebody would have talked to me. Like, I had bad acne in, like, high school, and I grew up, we had a backyard swimming pool. I was in chlorine water, like, constantly. I ate tons of not good food. I stayed up all night. Like, I took a zillion antibiotics as a kid. I had the whole recipe for that, like, pink chunky antibiotic liquid.
Oh, yeah, that's amoxicillin, the bubble, the pink bubble gum one.
God,
it's still around. It's like, that's right.
Bubble gum is a very generous way to describe the flavor of that stuff. But I got a lot of ear infections. I got tested for strep throat, like, I don't know how many times, to the point where I was scared to go to the doctor because they always jab that thing down your throat.
Oh, gosh.
And so the stick with the, anyways. Mm-hmm. All of it. And so I had bad acne, and, like, nobody ever suggested that it had anything to do with any of the stuff that we're talking about here.
Yes.
It was like, buy the thing from the store that's like acid and put it on your skin. That was like the solution to it. And then I would like burn the hell out of my face. And so I would have bought into that because of the motivation. And so it's like you're saying, like, find their motivation, find the thing that motivates that kid, because you can tie the microbiome and health of their microbiome and their gut into almost any
absolutely
thing that they want, right? Or anything they don't want, or whatever the situation is. So that's really helpful for food. And then, like, so you find that kids are more open then, once they understand this, to kind of eating the food that they're, I like the way you say it, their trillions of friends in their tummy, the food that those friends want, they become more open to eating foods that they maybe weren't eating before.
Absolutely. At least thinking about it, right? And then when we talk to them, and, you know, so, you know, as a mom and as a pediatrician, I understand if you're going to make something stick as a habit, first of all, it's got to be something that you can do every day, right? It's not just a one-off. Like, this is all about how do we create these lifestyle changes, right? And it's also really about making it fun and memorable and doable. Because if it's not memorable and fun, I mean, it's going to be hard to sustain it. It might be something you do for a couple of weeks or a month, and then you're like, it's just too much to think about. So you want to make it almost autopilot. And, you know, when we think about, you know, I in the book, I talk about the five things for microbiome magic. You know, how do we create, you know, resilience in your gut microbiome so that your skin and your hair and your muscles and whatever it is you want to be better, you know, can improve. And one of the cores, of course, is how we eat. And there's a couple of different options. But we know, I mean, our microbiome, what do they need? Our microbiota, right? Those tiny, tiny trillions of friends, they need plants. I mean, bottom line, like, they need to eat plants. And the foods that really sustain them are plants. And so I talk about our microbiome champions as the three Fs. So trying to remember that it's fiber, phytonutrients, which I know is a pH, but it sounds like an F. So fiber, phytonutrients, and fermented foods. So thinking more broadly, because every kid and parent has heard eat the rainbow, but they're applying that to fruits and vegetables. When we're thinking about, you know, our whole gut rainbow, it's not just fruits and vegetables. It's really, look at the Mediterranean diet. It's full of whole grains and legumes and nuts and seeds. If you can tolerate those, I mean, your legumes, nuts, and seeds and whole grains are going to pack way more fiber per bite than most fruits and vegetables. But then also thinking about the color. So every single color of the rainbow that we can think of in our fruits and vegetables, they have a different phytonutrient. I mean, people listening have heard of quercetin or resveratrol from red grapes, or EGCG, you know, from green tea, genistein from soy. Well, our microbiota use each of those phytonutrients, or phytochemicals, you might hear them called, to produce and shift produce changes and byproducts that shift our epigenetics. I mean, that's fascinating, right? These are sometimes even called epinutrients. I mean, you know, they can help really influence how our genes work for us or against us as we get older. And so with color, I have kids think about, you know, if you don't like, you know, 10 different kinds of fruits and vegetables, but you love broccoli, all right. A lot of kids love broccoli. Well, how about going to the farmer's market and trying to find some purple broccoli? Because that's a different color, different phytonutrients. That still counts as another thing, right? I mean, we have all sorts of different colors of cauliflower around us, and bell peppers come in different colors. So each color matters. So it's just trying to make these small little shifts there. And one of the things I talk about in the book, but also I talk with kids about, is trying to make every meal or snack pop. And what that means is, you know, how can we make this, whatever we're eating, pop with plants on purpose? And so, you know, if we're thinking about, let's say in the morning you're having a bowl of oatmeal and you have some raisins on there and some flax seeds, that's great, right? But how about then, if we want to make it pop, we're thinking about what's one more thing we can add to give it more microbiome power. And so, you know, maybe go to the pantry and find some pumpkin seeds that are kind of somewhere in the back and sprinkle that on. Or, you know, if you have some fresh blueberries in your fridge, put that on. So just what's one more thing? And when we think about that one more thing, there's always one more thing we can add. And it can even be spices, you know, cinnamon counts. You know, if you're making mashed potatoes and you put garlic in there, hey, how about reach for the parsley? I mean, that's going to count, right? So we're trying to make it just really simple, easy, and doable. And so, yeah, making meals pop is another way. You know, I remember talking about this in a little masterclass I was teaching, and a mom wrote me immediately afterwards and said my little 4-year-old was kind of listening in, because I do everything with a lot of color and, you know, try to make it fun. And so she was kind of looking to see what was so colorful on her screen, and with all the poop emojis and, you know, the things. And I was talking about making meals pop. And as soon as we got off, mom started to make dinner, and her 4-year-old went up to her and asked, "Are we going to make it pop?" And so it was so cute. And then she said, even the next morning, as the dad was making breakfast, the daughter asked the same thing, "What are you going to do to make it pop?" And so, you know, those kind of things, you know, will stick even as they get older. You know, you can think, oh, I mean, that's what I do now, is I think, okay, I make a salad. Oh, what's one more thing I can kind of add on? You know, that's probably in your pantry or your fridge.
And it kind of gamifies it. Like, it makes it fun. And then the parents are being held accountable. So it's like reverse of, I've had other people come on and talk about like how nefarious marketing is that targets kids for like breakfast cereals, or I don't know, insert random thing that's probably not good for the kids. And then they trick the kid into wanting it so that the kid will drag the parent to buy the thing because the marketing is aimed at the kids. This is like backwards. It's kind of like getting them parents into doing the thing that's beneficial for them. So then those acronyms and everything make it a lot easier. This is awesome stuff about food and kind of how to do this. And I've been trying to do this myself ever since we've been, you know, for the last couple of months working on a course with Kiran Krishnan from Microbiome Labs. And he talks about a lot of the same principles regarding, you know, feeding the microbiome. So I now am, when I'm cooking something or making something, I'm like, all right, this has 4 things in it. I need to put 7 things in it. Like, I can find a few more things to put
in this.
Right. And I found like combinations that I thought were strange that actually work pretty well. And then I heard you mention that the Mediterranean diet, for anybody listening who doesn't know, I live in Italy, and there's a lot of misconceptions around, well, one, that there's such a thing as Italian food. That doesn't exist. Italy's like 20 different little tiny countries that have different food and different language and different cultures and different, if you go up in the north, it's butter, not olive oil. It's beans, rice, not noodles as much, or not as much pasta. Like, there's no spicy food in the north. There's spicy food. So it's way different. But around here, I live in Tuscany, which is like north-ish, and there's tons of beans, to the point where other Italians refer to Tuscans as bean eaters in like a negative way.
Oh my
and
gosh,
so,
I've never heard that before.
Yeah, because there's like, if you go to the little grocer, there's probably 6, maybe more different types of like very regional local beans that you can buy that some are pink, some are white, some are, you know, brown, some are whatever. And they eat a lot of lentils here, lentils, beans. There is, what is with the rice that you cook forever that gets soft?
The risotto?
Risotto. That's more not here, but they eat it here. So like, yes, they eat a lot of pasta, but the misconception is that like every meal in Italy is pasta, pasta, pasta is the carb. And it's definitely not. They eat a lot of beans. They eat a lot of grains. They eat farro, a lot of farro.
Yes.
Which I never had had before I lived here, which is
I love it.
Sort of like barley. It's a little bit more oomph than couscous.
Like chewier,
or something.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's really good. And so they do eat a lot of different forms of like fibrous foods as well. And it's not just pasta. And even the pasta here, if you go into like a traditional grocer around here, they'll have pasta in like a bunch of different types of traditional grains.
Yeah.
It's not all just like highly refined white flour pasta like you'll see in the stores a lot of times in the States. It's like different colors and different, you can read history on the back of the bags of this grain comes from this place. So it is way, way, way more diverse in sources of fiber than people would think. But as far, this is all like dietary stuff and food things. On our, I think it was a brain and nervous system masterclass of ours that you were on, you talked about meditation and mindfulness practices and like breathing exercise and even like coherence or heart rate variability practices, like those kind of things for kids. Because I think we were talking about pans and pandas and things like that and ways to calm nervous system down in, yep. in highly activated states. Because there's a book, you've probably read it or you know of it. There's a book out now called, I think it's called The Anxious Generation or The Anxiety Generation.
It's called The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt.
Yeah, and I've only seen synopsis of it and like bullet points taken from it and like facts taken from it. So I don't want to quote it necessarily because I haven't read the whole thing, but there's some information that's come out of that book that's alarming with amount of anxiety in like Gen Z and younger, like because of social media, because well the theories are because of social media, because of the phones, because of the screens, because of all these things. And so kids are like more dysregulated than ever when it comes to the nervous system.
Yeah.
So and not just kids that have PANS or PANDAS or conditions like that that you work with, but like all the kids. And so I was so surprised the first time you talked about it, that you have kids, small kids too, do meditation or do breathing exercises. And then I saw you post a picture or something of your son who was really little doing meditation or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, I can't believe you get him to do that. And you're like, get him to do it. He likes to do it. So like, how do you introduce that to kids and parents? Like, because I mean, sure, you work collaboratively with parents and kids. Like, how do you introduce those things to them and like get them on board with doing those things?
So, I mean, first, it's really got to be something that you do every day, right? And you know, being, well, I guess there's two different issues here or factors. The first is still the education. So I still talk to kids about the gut-brain connection and what that means, right? Because every kid has had experiences of being really worried about something or feeling like, oh my gosh, I can't manage whatever's going on, even if you're a toddler. And of course, all the way up through our adolescence, because we have our crisis of mental health in our kids and teenagers. And so I talk to them about how that really does stem too from their gut microbiome and all of the neurotransmitters that we think are brain chemicals. I mean, most of them are made by our gut microbiota.
Yeah.
And so, you know, helping them to connect that and teaching them about what the vagus nerve is. And I talk to them about, you know, they have this information superhighway. It's a two-way street of communication that goes from the gut to the brain and the brain to the gut. And that's called the vagus nerve. And guess what? That vagus nerve, it controls virtually every single internal organ. And that is what we need to kick in when we're feeling anxious or stressed about something. And so they get that context of what the vagus nerve is, not in sort of a, you know, I hate to say it this way, but, you know, a lot of people, when we're talking about mind-body medicine, it's kind of more in that woo-woo, you know, mm-hmm. realm. And a lot of kids are kind of rolling their eyes or parents are rolling their eyes. And it's like, no, this is actually, there's a real physiologic mm-hmm. process going on. This is what's happening. And when we're anxious or stressed, and also, by the way, if we have any chronic inflammatory conditions going on, the vagus nerve is what will pull things back and rebalance our brain, our nervous system, our immune system, our, you know, our gut, our cardiovascular system, I mean, all of that. And so it puts that into context, makes it a little more concrete, makes it a little bit more like, oh, okay, this is something I have to do really for health reasons, not just to feel good. So then that gets a little bit more interest. And when I talk about vagus nerve work, I start with things that, you know, I say, look, these are things that you can do every day. Again, it's not asking you to add anything on, but one of the easiest things that you can do every day to kick in your vagus nerve is to learn how to breathe with your belly. So do that diaphragmatic breathing. And we sit in the office and I'll sit with the parents and, you know, demonstrate what diaphragmatic breathing is, with keeping your shoulder down while you're taking breaths in and only inhaling and inflating the balloon in your belly while keeping your shoulders down, and then exhaling and deflating the balloon in your belly, again, keeping your shoulders down. It is fascinating to see the parents and the kids where they're really trying to concentrate on their breathing, and it's not natural anymore. And they're kind of, you know, when they're breathing in, most of us kind of, right, we breathe in with our shoulders and we go down. And so they're trying to figure out how to keep their shoulders still. And so it takes practice. We have, as a society, really forgotten how to do this very natural diaphragmatic breathing that when you watch babies sleeping and breathing, that's what they're doing. I mean, they don't care about their bellies pooching out. I mean, their bellies are kind of going out and in.
They haven't been taught that that's some sort of negative thing.
That's right. That's right. And when kids and teenagers and adults, you know, for that matter, can really learn how to focus on their breath and, you know, really do that diaphragmatic breathing, you can do that anywhere, anytime, without anyone knowing that you're doing anything, right? Because a lot of teenagers are like, I don't want to do tapping or, you know, sit and meditate because I'm going to look weird, right? And so, you know, I get that. They don't want to look like they're doing something different. But breathing, you can do that anywhere. So I feel like that's just the most powerful thing that we can teach from an early age. You know, when we're getting really, you know, anxious about something, or, you know, we just got a horrible text from a friend, or we saw something on social media that was mean, and we're kind of, you know, getting into that fight or flight. Okay, if we just remember, okay, slow your breath down and then focus on the diaphragmatic breathing. Just after 10 breaths, you're just more clear in how you want to respond to that situation. Or, you know, as a baby or a toddler, if you're seeing, you know, your child getting worked up, then just sit down and say, you know what, mommy's going to do something, your daddy's going to do something. And, you know, I feel a little anxious. Are you feeling anxious? Or give them words for their feelings, right? Are you so frustrated that you can't get the circle in the square? Well, let's just sit and, you know, I'm going to breathe. Do you want to breathe with me? And just model just like those slow breaths. It can sit on your lap. There's something beautiful too with babies and kids. I mean, your teenagers may not want to do that so much. I mean, I still get my hugs in whenever I can. But, you know, if they're sitting with you, you know, back to your chest, or if you're hugging, and you can regulate your nervous system, slow down your breathing, which then slows down your heart rate, and just really slow yourself down. And which can be hard if your child is super upset and you're kind of, and you may also be triggered by that too, but you slow yourself down. That will help co-regulate your child. I mean, co-regulation is phenomenal. It's the same reason why, you know, and kids are especially attuned to how their parents are feeling. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same thing when you walk through the door, or let's say, you know, you're in the living room and, you know, your wife walks through the door, or maybe, you know, when your son's older, walks through the door. And even if you haven't seen their face or looked at them, you can feel how they're feeling. Like if you really are still and pay attention. And that's because we're constantly co-regulating with the energy around us. And so I would say, you know, as a parent, again, this is so cliche, you know, put your own life mask on first, but oxygen mask on first, but it is so important. If we want to help our kids get out of fight or flight, or, you know, help them with focus, help them manage whatever stress is going on, if we start with us, it helps them as they're starting to learn these tools.
For sure. And we're not trying to attack anybody out here, judge anyone. Like, I started learning about all this when I started doing all the trauma work like 6 years ago. And I started to think back to like things that happened when I raised my first son, and like times I was like really stressed out or really freaked out. And I was 18, 19 year old with a kid.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh man, he was around me and I was so stressed and I was this, and I started beating myself up. And then that's not good either. So no, everybody's doing the best that they can with the knowledge that they have, but this co-regulation and also like mirroring. I love that you said, you know, are you really frustrated? You know, what I like to do when I'm frustrated is do breathing. And then, because I think this might have been before we were recording, but he'll do anything I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that goes every which way. And for parents, that goes every way, that they'll do anything they see you
That's
doing.
Right.
And so we project, I think, like I did the first time you told me about these things you have kids do, whether it's these apps with the meditation or the breathing or heart math things or whatever. I was like, man, that's really weird for a kid to do that. Like, I couldn't imagine like little kids doing that. And me projecting that on a little kid would make them think it was weird and make them not do it. Whereas if I'm doing it, they're going to want to do it. And then they won't even think it's weird. Just like they're not self-conscious about letting their belly come out when they breathe. They have no idea. You tell a little three-year-old, like they would have no concept of that. Like it would be so silly. It'd be so silly to them. Like it should be silly to us, but it's, and I started learning that the breathing cue is great about keeping your shoulders down. I teach a lot of breathing and breath work things that I'll usually tell the group, like take a big deep breath, and 90% of them go.
That's right. Yeah.
And they breathe through their mouth, their shoulder goes up. It's a short, shallow breath, but it's fast. And then teaching them to breathe through their belly without their shoulders moving, it's really difficult for some people.
It is very difficult. Yes.
And I think the kids will pick it up faster probably than the adults, because they don't have as much time in dysfunctional breathing.
Yeah. It can be, I find it can be easier to have kids, you know, and grownups to just lay down and practice that, because then you can't really lift your shoulders up, and then even place a little, like a little notebook on their chest so that they're looking and seeing that, you know, you really just want to fill your diaphragm and your belly up. So, and I love that, you know, that you said just, you know, don't judge yourself, because we all come to this at different times. And even for me, you know, as I, you know, I was doing this work, I was an integrated pediatrician. I mean, when I was pregnant with my kids, I mean, long before I was pregnant with my kids, but there are still things that I've learned that I'm like, oh God, why didn't I learn that? And also, honestly, a lot of these habits and things that I talk and teach about, we didn't start doing them until my kids were older. I mean, you can start these if the younger they are. I mean, just even like, you know, learning how to read food labels. I mean, your toddler can't read, but they sure can. You can show them, oh, look, let's turn the package on the back. And, oh, mommy's going to read these ingredients. And some of them, I mean, if they might see like, oh, blueberries or rice or whatever it is. Do you know what that is? Oh, what about mono and diglycerides? Do you know what that is? You know, and just use that as an opportunity to say, oh, well, yeah, you know, that's a chemical. That's not real food. So, you know, we probably don't want to put this in our bodies. So just using all of those opportunities so that it becomes a habit that once they're in, you know, 12, 13, going out with their friends on their own, you know, to wherever, downtown or the movies, and buying their own food, it's just habitual to kind of turn the package over. And I mean, I'm not going to say my kids don't ever choose like the Mike and Ikes and whatever, like the gross stuff that I'm cringing at, but at least they have that habit so that I'm confident that when they get older, when they're out of the house on their own in college and beyond, that they're going to be able to look at packages and know which foods are, you know, kind of better, healthier for their microbiomes and for them, and which foods they want to, you know, find replacements for.
Yeah. It's, I think getting the habits set early is, everything's like almost like muscle memory in essence. It's not the same thing. It's more neuroplasticity, but it's like, it's harder to break habits and break patterns and change things the longer that you've been ingrained in them. So like starting when you're 35 is going to be harder.
Yep.
You know, at 35 than it would be if you were six and you were kind of doing it and kind of setting the stage. And, I like to teach people breathing on the ground too. You mentioned that. I like it because they can also feel the back part of their body inflate, like the, because it's 360 degrees. It's not just in the front. And that's, I found that if there's like a seat behind them or something on the ground, it's easy to feel like that more multi-directional expansion with the breathing. But so many good tips here, so many good suggestions on how to help kids kind of make these healthy choices part of their life. And to, whether it's mindfulness or meditation or breathing or how they're breathing, or it's the foods and the microbiome champions and getting more plants in the diet, or things, you know, like it would fit to exercise. Like that never used to be a problem with kids. Like in my generation was the first one to have video games, but we still played like tons outside and tons of sports and ran around and were crazy. I think that now is like the first couple generations where sedentary children is a thing.
It is a huge problem, and it became much worse over the pandemic with Zoom school. But it's not just Zoom schooling. I mean, never before have kids had constant attachment to a device that then, you know, they're sitting and they're looking at it. I mean, even you know, I mean, you look
and they don't go to like hang out with the, like when my son that's an adult now was in like high school, whenever video games started being played like together with other people, mostly online, which was probably when he was in high school, we didn't have that. So even if we were playing video games, if we wanted to play video games, like all of us had to go to someone's house to play the video game. So then we'd be sitting around playing the video game, but like you'd play it for a while, then you'd go play basketball, you'd do something that's outside, you'd go to somebody else's house, or you'd walk to the food place, or you'd do whatever thing. And now they don't have to leave the house and they don't hang out with each other, and they just sit there and they're all, quote, hanging out, but they're not hanging out, and there's no transportation, there's no movement, there's no activity. So like, I would guess that exercise even falls in this too. It's like teaching them what it does for their body, teaching them how much better they'll feel, teaching them ways to do it easily and do things that are fun, gamifying it. Like these principles probably apply to like every type of modification of lifestyle or diet that you'd want to do, right? Even getting them to go to bed earlier or...
Absolutely. And, you know, when we think about the screen time and, you know, it's diverges in the kind of puberty years once kids start having phones for, I mean, a lot of kids are getting phones very early on,
yeah.
But it tends to be that boys are more, you know, towards the video games. And then there's the addictive piece that can become a really big problem. For girls, it's more the social media. And with mm-hmm. that comes the increase in anxiety and depression. Regardless, you know, some of the studies have found that the higher the number, the higher the hours of screen time. I mean, I was just looking through one study that, you know, 5 or more hours per day of screen time, which actually is very easy to do. I mean, you look at kids' screen time and it's shocking that some of them have 7, 8+ hours. And you're like, weren't you in school? Like, what did you do, right? But that, like 5 or more hours could increase the suicide risk in these kids by 50%. And there was still, even at 2 hours or less, there was still an increased risk for suicide. And that becomes, you know, more pronounced with our girls. But one of the most protective factors in the studies that have looked at, okay, well, let's, you know, phones, screens, they're a part of life. I mean, we're not going to ever go back to a time where they're not there unless, you know, the world's electricity shuts down, right? But really, what else can we do? The single most protective factor was face-to-face in-person communication. Not sitting next to your friends on a device, but getting together and hanging out, you know, walking around downtown or going to the park or, you know, just face-to-face talking, making eye contact, you know, laughing and doing all the things.
Who'd have thunk it?
No, right? I mean, it's just...
such a mystery.
We have to get back to that balance because our, mm-hmm. I mean, our, like I said, our kids and teens, their mental health is in crisis. And with Jonathan Haidt's book, there is thankfully more awareness and more countries even that are starting to think about banning social media until you're a certain age, which I think is really important.
But it's also up to phones away, like
schools are taking phones away, you know, putting them in. I mean, my daughter has like a little bag, you know, a little wall cubby that all the students have to put their phones in. And, you know, we're making steps, but it also starts with parents. I mean, there's a report that came out earlier this year showing that parents who are distracted on their cell phones when they're interacting with their kids cause more distress in kids. I mean, those kids are more distressed and anxious. And that makes sense too. And we have to absolutely model that. Look, when we get in the door, we can put our device away and be, you know, 100% mindful. And of course, there's real life and you may have to get to an email or maybe there's an urgent text or whatever it is. All right, honey, I'm going to take, I need 5 minutes to do this. And then it goes away again, right? And so, I mean, we have to be able to model that. Otherwise, we cannot expect immature brains to just
to
be able
see
to
their
do
parent
it.
On the phone for 4 hours after they get off work, and then saying,
right.
"No, you can't be on a phone." It's like, yeah, right. I'm going to just go over there and do it.
Yeah.
So,
and I, it's not like. I mean, I'm far from perfect. And this is something that because sometimes I'll come home and have this list of things from work still to do. And I immediately, like you said, I'll go on and try to send off a few emails. And, you know, when you're home, you know, that time with your kids, try to be fully present. And then, you know, like I said, if you need to have 20 minutes, half an hour, then say, I need to carve this time out. I'm just going to finish this. Get it done. Don't try to interact with your kids, send an email, interact, send an email, right?
Just get the things done and be there.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
All right. Well, we're out of time. That was a lot of really helpful tips and suggestions. And I think it comes down to modeling. I think it comes down to, you know, educating them at the level that they're able to receive to help them understand what the benefits are, why they might want to do it. And then making things, you know, easy, accessible, fun, almost like a game. And playing the game also yourself.
Yes.
Like this isn't you're making your kids do all these things. It's everyone's doing these things together for the benefit of them and you. So it's a double win because everyone feels better.
Absolutely.
So. All right. Well, thank you so much. Where should people go if they want to get your book or learn about your work or find you or learn more?
Yeah. So my website is www.healthykidshappykids.com. You can find my book pretty much anywhere books are sold. I mean, of course, Amazon carries it, but also Barnes & Noble, Walmart, Target online. And then, of course, if you have your, you know, local indie bookstores, then please support them. I actually had a doctor friend of mine. She's from, I think she's from Bulgaria. And she sent me a picture that she found my book on the bookshelf in this small, you know, little bookstore there. It was so great.
Wow.
So, yeah. So look at your local bookstores. I was, you know, we have a little kids bookstore in our town, and I walked in, and my kids actually were the first ones to see it. They're like, mom, look. And so, it's so great, you know, to be able to spread the word. So, and then on Instagram is where I'm most active. So that's healthykids_happykids.
Great. And you share so much amazing info. This is just the tip of it. So if you want like a million tips on happy, healthy kids, follow the Instagram, check out the book. There's a wealth. You're very generous with your time and sharing your expertise. So thank you so much. I always enjoy these conversations. I always learn a lot, and I take a lot of notes on how to do with my own little guy. So he thanks you too. And look forward to connecting in the future.
All right. Thanks, Michael.